Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 15th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Life Stories, Paths Untrodden, Perils Unknown. I Stand Here Ironing, a Story About Consequences. Presented by Ingrid Christensen. The tape number is CHI-2002-10. Let's listen in.
I am doing a session today on Tilly Olson's short story called I Stand Here Ironing. And I'm going to read it from this book, which has been selling out in the bookstore all summer. They order new batches and then they sell out. It's a wonderful new anthology of short stories called You've Got to Read This. Contemporary American writers introduced stories that held them in awe. And this is one of those stories that holds a lot of us in awe. Tilly Olson was born in, I think, 1917. And so this is one of her early stories. She came of age in the Depression. And the fact that she came of age in the Depression affects this story. This particular story includes a lot about poverty in it, but also about system-wide poverty, the poverty of a whole culture that doesn't have enough resources. I want to read you a thing or two about her history, because I think that her history sheds some light on a story. If I could only find a story in this book, I'd be happier. Here it is, 457. She was a young activist and radical in her early years. Can you imagine a Scandinavian activist? Scandalous. And I always take comfort in the fact that she was. Where is it? Here. She was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1913, the second of six children of Jewish immigrants. She joined the Young Communist League in the early 30s and then moved to California, where she married and worked as a union organizer, a waitress, a laundress, and a secretary before enrolling in creative writing classes at San Francisco State. And then it tells that she's gotten a number of awards. And so many of us who love short stories think that she's one of the best short story writers around. I'm going to read you this story, but first I'm going to ask you to just help you sort of think about the story as you're listening to it. I want to just ask you to think about a few questions and points. And since my handwriting is illegible, I will read them to you. One of my favorite quotes out of the story is this: "So all that is in her will not bloom there." So think about that. So all that is in her will not bloom. The story is about a mother writing about her 19-year-old daughter. And her 19-year-old daughter is an actress. And the mother gets a note from a teacher. And the teacher is probably her acting teacher. And that's how the story sprang up. I want you to think about, is this narrator, the mother, the writer, the speaker in the story, is she talking about her own guilt or is it grief? How do you think it plays between guilt and grief that she's expressing? What is the stage of this story? What are the times like? What is the culture? What do you learn about the time that this family lived in by this way this story is written? Is something resolved in the story? Does the story get somewhere? Does it go to a different place? Does it start in one place and have a resolution, go to a new place? Who do you identify with in this story? It's interesting to me that I have been reading this story since my children were babies. And there are some parts of the story that made me cry when my children were babies, and there are other parts of the story that I'll have a tough time getting through today. And my children are young adults now. So find if there's some part of the story that attaches to you, that hits your heart, that affects you. Who do you identify with? Do you identify with the mother, for example, or the daughter? What are the rhythms of the story? Those of you who have ironed know that ironing is a rhythm, and I stand here ironing has some real rhythms in it that I think are fun to kind of pick out and discern and look at. What does it mean that, and the mother says, something goes back and forth, her thoughts go back and forth with the iron. So think about the rhythms in the story. There's some interesting use of color in this story, especially the color red. And there's interesting use of food and hunger and the relationship of people to food. There are some questions of fault. Is the fault, if there is a fault in this story, the mother's fault, the fault of the times, the daughter's fault, the fault of poverty? Could it have been different if someone wasn't at fault, or one of those things wasn't at fault? Questions of the importance of money and the importance of love. Think about those things. How powerful is money? How powerful is love? What is the relationship between money and love? And then the last thing I'm going to want us to think about when we talk afterwards is the mother okay? Is the daughter okay? Is the family okay at the end? Or is there something, is there really not okay? So with those comments, sit back, relax. It's too bad it's not raining. You could have a nice rainy day story. But enjoy Tilly Olson's use of language in this beautiful story called I Stand Here Ironing. I stand here ironing, and what you asked me moves, tormented, back and forth with the iron. I wish you would manage the time to come in and talk with me about your daughter. I'm sure you can help me understand her. She's a youngster who needs help and whom I'm deeply interested in helping, is a quote from a note that the mother is reading. Who needs help? Even if I came in, what good would it do? You think because I'm her mother, I have a key, or that in some way you could use me as a key. She has lived for 19 years. There is all that life that has happened outside of me, beyond me. And when is there time to remember, to sift, to weigh, to estimate, to total? I will start and there will be an interruption and I will have to gather it all together again. Or I will become engulfed with all I did or did not do, with what should have been and what cannot be helped. She was a beautiful baby. The first and only one of our five that was beautiful at birth. You do not guess how new and uneasy her tenancy in her now loveliness is. You did not know her all those years she was thought homely, or see her poring over her baby pictures, making me tell her over and over how beautiful she had been, and would be, I would tell her, and was now to the seeing eye. But the seeing eyes were few or non-existent, including mine. I nursed her. They feel that is important nowadays. I nursed all the children, but with her, with all the fierce rigidity of first motherhood, I did like the books then said. Though her cries battered me to trembling and my breasts ached with swollenness, I waited until the clock decreed. Why do I put that first? I do not even know if it matters or if it explains anything. She was a beautiful baby. She blew shining bubbles of sound. She loved motion, loved light, loved color and music and textures. She would lie on the floor in her blue overalls, patting the surface so hard, in ecstasy, her hands and feet would blur. She was a miracle to me, but when she was 8 months old, I had to leave her, daytimes, with a woman downstairs, to whom she was no miracle at all. For I worked, or looked for work, and for Emily's father, who, quote, could no longer endure, he wrote in his goodbye note, sharing want with us. I was 19. It was the pre-relief, pre-WPA world of the Depression. I would start running as soon as I got off the streetcar, running up the stairs, the place smelling sour. And awake or asleep to startle awake, when she saw me, she would break into a clogged weeping that could not be comforted. A weeping I can hear yet. After a while, I found the child passing at night, so I could be with her days, and it was better. But it came to where I had to bring her to his family and leave her. It took a long time to raise the money for her fare back. Then she got chicken pox, and I had to wait longer. When she finally came, I hardly knew her, walking quick and nervous like her father, looking like her father, thin, and dressed in a shoddy red that yellowed her skin and glared at the pockmarks. All the baby loveliness was gone. She was 2. Old enough for nursery school, they said, and I did not know then what I now know. The fatigue of the long day and the lacerations of group life in the kind of nurseries that are only parking places for children. Except that it would have made no difference if I had known. It was the only place there was. It was the only way we could be together, the only way I could hold a job. And even without knowing, I knew the teacher was evil, because all these years it has curdled into my memory, the little boy hunched in the corner, her rasp. Why aren't you outside? Because Alvin hits you? That's no reason to go out. Go out, scaredy. I knew Emily hated it, even if she did not clutch and implore, "Don't go, Mommy," like the other children, mornings. She always had a reason why we should stay home. "Mama, you look sick." "Mama, I feel sick." "Mama, the teachers aren't there today. They're sick." "Mama, we can't go. There was a fire there last night." "Mama, it's a holiday today. No school. They told me." Never a direct protest, never rebellion. I think of our other children in their 3- and 4-year-oldness, the explosions, the tempers, the denunciations, the demands, and I feel suddenly ill. I put the iron down. What in me demanded that goodness in her? And what was the cost to her of such goodness? The old man living in the back once said in his gentle way, "You should smile at Emily more when you look at her." What was in my face when I looked at her? I loved her. They were all acts of love. It was only with the others I remembered what he said, and it was the face of joy and not of care or tightness or worry I turned to them. Too late for Emily. She does not smile easily, let alone almost always as her brothers and sisters do. Her face is closed and somber, but when she wants, how fluid. You must have seen it in the pantomimes. You spoke of her rare gift for comedy on the stage that rouses a laughter out of the audience. So dear, they applaud and applaud and do not want to let her go. Where does it come from, that comedy? There was none of it in her when she came back to me that second time, after I had had to send her away again. She had a new daddy now to learn to love, and I think perhaps it was a better time. Except when we left her alone nights, telling ourselves she was old enough. "Can't you go some other time, Mommy, like tomorrow?" she would ask. "Will it be just a little while you'll be gone? Do you promise?" The time we came back, the front door opened, the clock on the floor in the hall. She, rigid, awake. It wasn't just a little while. I didn't cry. 3 times I called you, just 3 times. And then I ran downstairs to open the door so you could come faster. The clock talked loud. I threw it away. It scared me what it talked. She said the clock talked loud again the night I went to the hospital to have Susan. She was delirious with the fever that comes before red measles. But she was fully conscious all the week I was gone and the week after we were home when she could not come near the new baby or me. She did not get well. She stayed skeleton thin, not wanting to eat, and night after night she had nightmares.
She would call for me, and I would rouse from exhaustion to sleepily call back, "You're all right, darling. Go back to sleep. It's just a dream." And if she still called, in a sterner voice, "Now go to sleep, Emily. There's nothing to hurt you." Twice, only twice, when I had to get up for Susan anyhow, I went in to sit with her. Now, when it is too late, as if she would let me hold and comfort her like I do the others, I get up and go to her at once at her moan or restless stirring. "Are you awake, Emily? Can I get you something?" And the answer is always the same. "No, I'm all right. Go back to sleep, Mother." They persuaded me at the clinic to send her away to a convalescent home in the country where, quote, "she can have the kind of food and care you can't manage for her, and you'll be free to concentrate on the baby." They still send children to that place. I see pictures on the society page of sleek young women planning affairs to raise money for it, or dancing at the affairs, or decorating Easter eggs, or filling Christmas stockings for the children. They never have a picture of the children, so I do not know if the girls still wear those gigantic red bows and the ravaged looks on every other Sunday when parents can come to visit, unless they've been otherwise notified, as we were notified the first 6 weeks. Oh, it is a handsome place. Green lawns and tall trees and fluted flower beds. High up on the balconies of each cottage, the children stand, the girls in their red bows and white dresses, the boys in white suits and giant red ties. The parents stand below, shrieking up to be heard, and the children shriek down to be heard. And between them, the invisible wall, not to be contaminated by parental germs or physical affection. There was a tiny girl who always stood hand in hand with Emily. Her parents never came. One visit, she was gone. "They moved her to the Rose Cottage," Emily shouted in explanation. "They don't like you to love anybody here." She wrote once a week, the labored writing of a seven-year-old. "I am fine. How is the baby? If I write my letter nicely, I will have a star. Love." There never was a star. We wrote every other day, letters she could never hold or keep, but only hear read once. Quote, "We simply do not have room for children to keep any personal possessions," they patiently explained, when we pieced one Sunday's shriekings together to plead how much it would mean to Emily, who loved so to keep things, to be allowed to keep her letters and cards. Each visit, she looked frailer. "She isn't eating," they told us. "They had runny eggs for breakfast or mush with lumps," Emily said later. "I'd hold it in my mouth and not swallow. Nothing ever tasted good, just when they had chicken." It took us 8 months to get her released home, and only the fact that she gained back so little of her 7 lost pounds convinced the social worker. I used to try and hold and love her after she came back, but her body would stay stiff, and after a while she'd push away. She ate little, food sickened her, and I think much of life, too. Oh, she had physical lightness and brightness, twinkling by on skates, bouncing like a ball up and down and up and down over the jump rope, skimming over the hill, but these were momentary. She fretted about her appearance, thin and dark and foreign-looking, at a time when every little girl was supposed to look, or thought she should look, a chubby, blonde replica of Shirley Temple. The doorbell sometimes rang for her, but no one seemed to come and play in the house or be a best friend. Maybe because we moved so much. There was a boy she loved painfully through 2 school semesters. Months later, she told me how she had taken pennies from my purse to buy him candy. Licorice was his favorite, and I bought him some every day, but he still liked Jennifer better than me. "Why, Mommy?" The kind of question for which there is no answer. School was a worry to her. She was not glib or quick in a world where glibness and quickness were easily confused with ability to learn. To her overworked and exasperated teachers, she was an over-conscientious, quote, slow learner, who kept trying to catch up and was absent entirely too often. I let her be absent, though sometimes the illness was imaginary. How different from my now strictness about attendance with the others. I wasn't working, we had a new baby, I was home anyhow. Sometimes, after Susan grew old enough, I would keep her home from school too and have them all together. Mostly, Emily had asthma, and her breathing, harsh and labored, would fill the house with a curiously tranquil sound. I would bring the two old dresser mirrors and her boxes of collections to her bed. She would select beads and single earrings, bottle tops and shells, dried flowers and pebbles, old postcards and scraps, all sorts of oddments. Then she and Susan would play Kingdom, setting up landscapes and furniture, peopling them with action. Those were the only times of peaceful companionship between her and Susan. I have edged away from it, that poisonous feeling between them, that terrible balancing of hurts and needs. I had to do between the two, and did so badly those earlier years. Oh, there are conflicts between the others, too, each one human, needing, demanding, hurting, taking, but only between Emily and Susan. No, Emily toward Susan, that corroding resentment. It seems so obvious on the surface, yet it is not obvious. Susan, the second child, Susan, golden and curly-haired and chubby, quick and articulate and assured, everything in appearance and manner Emily was not. Susan, not able to resist Emily's precious things, losing or sometimes clumsily breaking them. Susan telling jokes and riddles to company for applause, while Emily sat silent to say to me later, "That was my riddle, Mother. I told it to Susan." Susan, who for all the 5 years difference in age, was just a year behind Emily in developing physically. I was glad for that slow physical development that widened the difference between her and her contemporaries, though she suffered over it. She was too vulnerable for the terrible world of youthful competition, of preening and parading, of constant measuring of yourself against every other, of envy. If I only had that copper hair, or if I had that girl's skin. She tormented herself about not looking like the others. There was enough of the unsureness, the having to be conscious of words before you speak, the constant caring. What are they thinking of me? Without having it all magnified by the merciless physical drives of adolescence. Ronnie is calling. He is wet and I change him. It is rare there is such a cry now. That time of motherhood is almost behind me, when the ear is not one's own, but must always be racked and listening for the child cry, the child call. We sit for a while and I hold him, looking out over the city spread in charcoal with its soft aisles of light. Sugarly, he breathes and curls closer. I carry him back to bed, asleep. Sugarly, a funny word, a family word, inherited from Emily, invented by her to say comfort. In this and other ways, she leaves her seal, I say aloud, and startle at my saying it. What do I mean? When did I start to gather together to try and make coherent? What did I start to gather together to make coherent? I was at the terrible growing years, war years. I do not remember them well. I was working. There were four smaller ones now. There was not time for her. She had to be a help to her mother, a housekeeper, a shopper. She had to set her seal. Mornings of crisis and near hysteria, trying to get lunches packed, hair combed, coats and shoes found, everyone to school or childcare on time, the baby ready for transportation, and always the paper scribbled on by smaller ones, the book looked at by Susan, then mislaid, the homework not done. Running out to that huge school where she was one, she was lost, she was a drop, suffering over her unpreparedness, stammering and unsure of her classes. There was so little time left at night after the kids were bedded down. She would struggle over books, always eating. It was in those years she developed her enormous appetite that is legendary in our family. And I would be ironing or preparing food for the next day or writing V-mail to Bill or tending the baby. Sometimes to make me laugh or out of her despair, she would imitate happenings or types at school. I think I said once, why don't you do something like this in the school amateur show? So one morning she phoned me at work, hardly understandable through the weeping. Mother, I did it. I won. They gave me first prize. They clapped and clapped and wouldn't let me go. Now suddenly she was a somebody. Now suddenly she was somebody, and as imprisoned in her difference as a somebody as she had been in her anonymity. She began to be asked to perform at other high schools, even in colleges, then at city and statewide affairs. The first one we went to, I only recognized her that first moment when, thin and shy, she almost drowned herself into the curtains. Then, was this Emily? The control, the command, the convulsing and deadly clowning, the spell. Then the roaring, stamping audience, unwilling to let this rare and precious laughter out of their lives. Afterwards, people said, you ought to do something about her with a gift like that. But without money or knowing how, what does one do? We have left it all to her, and the gift has as often eddied inside, clogged and clotted, as has been used in growing. She's coming now. She runs up the stairs, two at a time, with her light grace, graceful step, and I know she is happy tonight. Whatever it was that occasioned your call did not happen today. Aren't you ever going to finish the ironing, Mother? Whistler painted his mother in a rocker. I'd have to paint mine standing over an ironing board. This is one of her communicative nights, and she tells me everything and nothing as she fixes herself a plate of food out of the icebox. She is so lovely. Why did you want me to come in at all? Why were you concerned? She will find her way. She starts up the stairs to bed. Don't get me up with the rest in the morning, she said. But I thought you were having midterm exams. Oh, those. She comes back in, kisses me, and says quite lightly, in a couple of years, when we'll all be Adam dead, they won't matter a bit. She has said that before. She believes it. But because I have been dredging up the past and all that compounds a human being is so heavy and meaningful in me, I cannot endure it tonight. I will never total it all. I will never come in to you and say, she was a child seldom smiled at. Her father left me before she was a year old. I had to work her first 6 years when there was work, or I sent her home to his relatives. There were years she had care she hated. She was dark and thin and foreign looking, in a world where the prestige went to blondness and curly hair and dimples. She was slow where glibness was prized. She was a child of anxious, not proud, love. We were poor and could not afford for her the soil of easy growth. I was a young mother. I was a distracted mother. There were other children pushing up, demanding. Her younger sister seemed all that she was not. There were years she did not let me touch her. She kept too much to herself. Her life was such she had to keep too much in to herself. My wisdom came too late. She has much to her, and probably little will come of it. She is a child of her age, of depression, of war, of fear. Let her be. So all that is in her will not bloom. But in how many does it? There is still enough left to live by. Only help her to know Help make it so there is a cause for her to know that she is more than this dress on the ironing board, helpless before the iron. Isn't that a lovely story?
Yeah.
So, what do you make of it? How does it make you feel? Betsy, what did you say?
I just wanted to ask you a question. Remember they said she had a new father? What happened to the second husband?
He stayed. He was the father of the second, third, and fourth, and fifth child.
Okay.
The first husband is one that left when the baby was little. Because, and the quote is hard to understand when you just hear it, but he says, "I cannot bear to share want with you." In other words, I don't like seeing my wife and child be poor. Mm. And you sort of want to say, "Give me a break, you know, get a job."
You'd stick around, we would too.
Even if he'd done the babysitting, well, she went and got a job.
Yeah, right.
Men couldn't do that in those days.
Yeah. Do you want to say more about how that was?
Well, I don't know. I think that's been the problem a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That the men have a certain idea at that time of what they could do. It's refreshing now to see some of the husbands do otherwise.
Yeah, there are a lot of stay-at-home dads. There are a lot of them up here at Holden.
Yeah.
Joyce.
It says who you identify with.
Uh-huh.
When you said when you read about the smile, she said you should smile at her more, or when you see her smile.
Uh-huh.
I can remember at a period of my life, my mother, you know, I would go to my mother's house, and when I rang the bell and she looked down and see it's me, she didn't have a smile on her face, and it was like a plain look. And I would always, every time I came, I started looking. I stopped going back, stopped going for a while. And that hurted me real bad. And now that I have changed my life and I go to my mother's house, before I get there and I see her, I call and wave. And, you know, I always greet her. And we have a better relationship, and it's a good thing now.
That's nice. I love to see your smile too. That's great. Do you want to say something?
Me?
Or was that a fly or a swat?
Yeah, I want to say something. I want to relate to that part too about who do you identify with. Actually, I can identify with the writer and the person she's with, Emily. I can relate to Emily and the mother. In my situation, I was the mother. I'm the mother. And my daughter was, her name was Sierra, and she was mature for her age. And every time I would leave out the door, she would say, "Marcel, coming back, Marcel." And I'll be like, "Yeah, girl, I'm coming back." And then I'd come, and then she'd say, "Marcel, where you been, Marcel?" You know, I have another daughter too, who I haven't been in her life. But today, like right before, the day before we came to Holden, I got a letter from her through the mail, and she's very young. And she assured me that no matter what, she loved me. And I haven't been there at all. But she is, and she's very young, she's 10. And to hear that from her gives me hope, you know, to keep on, keep going and stuff.
And that hope business is important about this story. I mean, I think you should see, go see her, write her a letter or something to respond to that, because this child grew up, at times you would have despaired. You know, when she was 7 months in that perfectly awful orphanage where she was supposed to be getting better and she got thinner and they wouldn't let the parents come and touch her. And the parents could only come every other Sunday. Oh, I just wanted to strangle those people. But the love, persistent love of the mother had to have an effect on that. The mother says in the end, there are years when she wouldn't let me touch her. But she doesn't say that she still won't let me touch her.
And she said she didn't say that she quit trying to touch her either.
That's exactly right.
Number G bothers me up there. You said fault. If it was the mother, the times, poverty, you know, couldn't it have been different?
Mm-hmm.
I found no fault in that story. I think the mother, I can relate basically to both the mother and the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I, as a child growing up, and how I perceived things then.
Mm-hmm.
And as a mother of two children, things that I should have done or could have done better, and most mothers probably go through that you think back and it's too late, but you keep trying to do better. But anyway, I saw no fault in there. I think the mother did the best she could.
Mm-hmm.
She and the stepfather did not just send this child off. They were told by, it sounded like to me, a caseworker or whatever to do this.
Mm-hmm.
They probably had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it does say it took us 8 months to get her out of there, which leads me to believe they immediately saw that this was not a good healing place. There was never a lack of love that I saw in there. And trying to reach this child, things in life, I feel a lot of them happen with no fault. That you don't need to point a finger.
Mm-hmm.
Things happen and you pick up and try to do better and go on from there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to dwell with what I should have, could have, didn't do kind of thing a lot of times.
Thank you, that's very helpful. Can anyone see any place in the story where it was the mother's fault?
No, I saw them very much a victim of her, the times and pressures, but also of being a very young mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think a lot of first-time mothers, particularly when they're young, are overwhelmed by the responsibility.
Yeah.
And while they feel the love, the most important thing is how do you keep this child safe and secure?
To do it right.
To do it right.
Yeah.
And I almost think there's a pattern you can often see in a first child that becomes very independent very soon because there's a kind of co-parenting between the child and the mother.
Mm, interesting.
And I could identify with that, having had a child at 20 and sort of, you know, oh, I could have done it the other way. And I remember seeing my second child relaxing and knowing all the fun I was going to be able to have. I felt none of that when I saw the first child.
Mm-hmm.
So I just knew how, you know, I didn't know what to do next. And I think sometimes being wanting to be a perfect mother puts on the being a perfect child. So when she talked about the child not being demanding, I could really understand that too, is that often a first child isn't very demanding.
Yeah.
But I don't think she could have done it any other way.
I remember my husband and I looking at each other when our second child was about 2 weeks old or something and thinking, what was so hard before? We couldn't figure out why it was so hard the first time around. What do you think about that, related to that? What do you think about, why did she say at the beginning, I nursed her? They feel that's important nowadays. I nursed all the children, but with her, you know, and it goes on about how she read in a book that you should nurse by the clock every, what, three hours or 4 hours or something. So she said that her breasts were bursting with milk and the child is lying in the cradle screaming, crying for milk. But she would wait until the clock decreed. So that supports.
Oh, I remember that too. Mm-hmm. My mother telling me, well, this is the way you have to do it. You have to get them in this pattern. Well, and wanting to do it another way. And then feeling very envious years later when women were encouraged to go with the flow with the baby, you know. And I'm thinking, why couldn't it be like that when my son was a baby? And I think it's sad, but I think, once again, it's the theory of the time trying to do. Mm-hmm.
But it was, she wasn't doing it to be mean or anything.
No,
she was,
no.
She was trying to do her best.
I was told that you should nurse. And I tried, and I couldn't. I mean, my husband was gone. He was in the Navy. He didn't see her till she was 4 months old. I was living with another woman that had four children at the time. This is my first child. I brought her home the day of my 21st birthday, and I almost dehydrated this child because I'm supposed to nurse. Well, little did I know, she wasn't getting the nourishment. I wound up taking her back to the doctor, and oh my God, I'm trying to kill my own baby. You know, why didn't I know she wasn't getting this nourishment? Nobody told me that these things happen. And so then we went to the bottle, but even with the bottle, it was the old clock thing. And I mean, it was awful. Thank God I was with a woman who had four children, and she taught me to relax some. My son came along, and in 2 years they changed the program. We had to learn something all over again.
Oh, you're willing to throw it away.
At that point, I did. At that point, I said, forget it. I'm listening to this baby who's crying all night long, and I wasn't supposed to feed any solid foods to at that time till he was like a year. I said bologna after 2 weeks and went and got some rice cereal and diluted it down, stuck it in a bottle with a big hole. And I'd take this child to the doctor and he'd say, oh, you can start feeding him cereal now. Oh, thank you very much. He's been eating it, you know, for 6 months. Well, you can add a little egg yolk to it. Oh, we've tried that and he loves it. Finally, this doctor threw up his hands and says, forget it. You know, just do what you want to do. He's healthy, he's growing, you know, I'm going to tell you.
Great.
But it was, and that's this lady. She didn't know.
Mm-hmm. So you had a hand back there, I think, didn't you? I saw a couple more hands in through here. Who's next?
Well, G, right? In the beginning, or somewhere in the story, the mom said something to the effect that some days she knew her daughter didn't want to go to school. Mm-hmm. And to me, what I got out of that was that because she tried to get this guy to like her, he chose the other girl instead. And through that, she didn't want to go to school. And her mother knew that sometimes when she said she was sick, she knew that it was just in her mind. Mm-hmm. And she was just trying to escape that. Couldn't the mother have encouraged her in some kind of way? I don't know if I'm trying to say the mother is faulty or not, but maybe I am, because
she said that later she's made all her kids go to school all the time, but with this first one she let her stay home. What's your sense of why she let her stay home?
Probably because she knew that she was hurt and feeling inferior to those children. And
well, I think that there have been so many things that had been really difficult for this child, with, you know, the places she had to be sent away and things that maybe she was trying to compensate for that a little bit by allowing her to stay home. Mm-hmm.
Could it be also that she, the mother, was still without the second husband?
And no, if she had the second
she
husband.
She had the second husband right then. Yeah. Okay.
But I think that compensation thing is part of it. I mean, she might have known that her daughter had fears at school. At one point, she had a fear of not being a good, fast enough reader, you know, the boyfriend incident, or various reasons. But I think she was compensating. She was.
And another thing is that, you know, I think no matter how much you try, you can't treat all your kids the same.
That's right.
When you say
you love them, but you love them in different ways.
Because she was sent away because she was sick.
And so the mom let her stay home from school for the fact she had to be sent away as a infant.
Because the child's first 6 years were so hard, the mom wanted to go give her extra love and leeway. But sometimes that can be destructive, to give a kid too much leeway and you can make trouble. Yes, Mark, and then Patsy.
I was going to mention a little bit about my livelihood. And one of the things that my biological mother and father, that she started having children when she was 17, and she had one right after another, and there were 9 of us. And I think part of that inability to understand the facets of that made the government realize that they weren't taking care of us, and ended up we were part of the assimilation era where children were taken away from their families because of both the poverty or not being taken care of, but also it was part of the way the government was trying to have the Native people become the mainstream of society.
Taking
away language and culture. Mm-hmm. And when I turned 18, was able to come back and find my biological mother and father and one of my older sisters. Mm-hmm. I only asked my mother one time, you know, why was I given up? And it ended up happening, but both of us cried.
Oh, Mark, that's so sad.
I'm
so sorry that happened.
Mm-hmm. I can identify both with the mother and the father. Yeah. Our mother and the daughter.
And the child.
And
Mark, that's a good point. I wanted to say, how much of this, I think I have in here somewhere, how much of it was the times which would be cultural production of poverty or cultural production of attitudes toward children? How much of this story, because it was rooted in the Depression, where there was want, where there wasn't enough work, where people didn't have resources, and she said it was before there was any attempt to do family support, public welfare, or any kind of public sponsoring of child care. If there had been a different culture that they had lived in, if there had been more services, more support services, if she'd had resources so that she could have gotten help finding work, or she could have gotten some decent child care, or gotten transportation, or anything, would that have made a difference? Probably it would have.
Just real quick, who is one person at fault that I see? That's her first husband. Because he was a coward, he ran out on his family. And even if he couldn't find work there by being depressed, if he would have went to another town or another state, he could have sent money back to his family, and that would have made it easy for her.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all. Good
job.
And were you going to say something?
Mm-mm.
I just wanted to ask, at the very beginning of that story,
mm-hmm.
it sounded like that the mother's thought process was put into being because of a note from this girl's teacher,
mm-hmm.
or drama teacher,
from
something
drama
like that.
Teacher. Right. She's standing ironing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And she's thinking over her response to this note. The teacher says, "Come in and talk to me about your daughter. I care very much about her, and I want to help. I want you to help me understand her." And then it was hard to understand because I was reading it and you weren't reading it with your eyes, but several times through the story, she says, "Even if I were to come in and talk to you,"
right.
and then finally toward the end, she says, "I'm not going to come in and talk to you."
Mm-hmm.
So
okay,
her decision is, she's not going to go see the teacher.
Yeah.
The girl's 19. At this point in our common life, I've been a college professor. I know I couldn't have written such a note to a parent. It would be illegal.
Not at 19.
No. Right. It would not. You can't poke around in there. I mean, in actual fact, I have disobeyed the law and phoned parents about my students and said, "I want to talk to you about your child." But I don't think it's legal to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a 19-year-old is supposedly they get their own grades, they get their own, you know, they're on their own. But at this time, during the Depression, you could, a 19-year-old student of yours, you could write the parents and say, help me understand your child. What do you think about her decision not to go and see the teacher?
I think that's okay, and at that age of the child, and I can't quote this, so I wish I could, but you can help me if I get it too poorly here, but one of those last comments in the whole story, she says something to the effect that, well, she won't, every flower in her world will lose something, or,
right.
or we won't, in effect, reach any her school potential anywhere, rarely does anyone. And I have to buy into that, and I think that comes from the whole story in perspective for me. So this 19-year-old now has found something that's hers, and she's on the scene now, and she's got something she can be involved with, happy with. And I think that carries her forward into adulthood.
That's so important.
Can you refer to the pickup
yes.
line that I...
Yes. We were poor and could not afford for her the soil of easy growth. And then later she says, so the soil of easy growth would have been what? Money, family supporting her, maybe, if she'd had, you know. She is a child of her age, of depression, of war, of fear. So let her be, so all that is in her will not bloom. But in how many does it? There is still enough left to live by. Only help her to know, help make it so there is cause for her to know that she is more than this dress on the ironing board, helpless before the iron. So what is the iron in there?
Desire or expectation. I thought the story ended up with a lot of hope.
Thank you.
Because I felt that one of the reasons she decided not to go to the teacher was that she could see when the girl bounced in that she was okay in the here and now, and that she was capable of making her own decisions and doing her own thinking. Maybe I'm projecting into that, but I felt that through it, there was both guilt and grief being, maybe it was the tone of your voice and the way in which you read it, but there was guilt and grief, but somehow she got to a position of resolving it. When she saw that the girl was an agency, or had her own agency about where her priorities were and what she was doing. And the fact that she could go on talking to her mother, this would be the day she disclosed the whole lot, and some days she wouldn't. Sounds pretty ordinary to me.
So you would say, in answer to the question, is something resolved in this story?
I think she resolved that she did the best she could. She grieved the fact that she couldn't have done it. Looking back, she had some ideas of what she could have done differently. But as life moves on, she was okay with what happened.
So she was grieving, in fact, the fact that she was living in poverty. Mm-hmm. She was grieving the fact that there was no way that she could have not done many of the things that she did. Three times the girl went away, didn't she? She went once to the ex-husband's family, mm-hmm. where she came back in the red dress, looking thin and pale and awful. The second time she was...
I thought she went to the family twice.
Mm-hmm. Then she went to the family once, twice. Then she was...
The
place where she was for 8 months.
But there were two places between there.
Two.
And Rachel was involved in each one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Would you say red was a good color in there?
Mm-hmm.
Everything from the red measles to the red bows mm-hmm. to the red, you know, yes. red, everything was negative around red.
Yeah.
But she was grieving. What would have happened if the story had been written from a different point of view? What if it had been written from the daughter's point of view, saying, oh, poor me, I had a terrible childhood, all these awful things happened to me. Would you have been so moved by the story?
Sorry, I didn't have a question.
If the story had been written by the daughter's point of view, the same set of facts had been expressed through the daughter's mouth, poor me, I had a terrible childhood, all these awful things happened to me. Mm-mm. Would you have found that as convincing, Wanda? Why not?
It would not have been the same, because it would have been like she was blaming, you know, her parents or whoever was raising her for what happened to her in her life as a child.
Complaining.
I wouldn't have been able to, you know, I wouldn't have been able to get that same from her because of that.
And the daughter wouldn't have had the same perspective as the mother.
Right.
The daughter probably would have said, my childhood was okay. I didn't like the 8 months gone and this and that. And something happened to me, and I'll just share real quickly. We raised four children. And I can pick out as a more mature adult, who started very young at age 21, as a more mature adult, I can pick out things I did really wrong in raising my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I can beat myself on those. I can really beat myself up. And I have three boys and a girl. And so I said one time to several, two of the boys were together, and we were just having a good time. And I says, you know, I really did a lousy job. And I outlined things that I did for, mm-hmm. that I did poorly in raising them. You know what they said? Dad, we don't remember that.
So, and you've been beating yourself all these years.
All these bruises. So I just relate that the daughter is going to have a different perspective than the mother.
What gift did the daughter have in her?
Comedy.
The gift for comedy. She was an actress, and she was spectacularly good at it.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as she did her acting in grammar school or middle school or whenever it was, people just craved mm-hmm. her presence on mm-hmm. stage. And when we say, so all that is in her will not bloom, still we look at her and recognize that much that is in her is blooming.
Mm-hmm.
She's 19, she's already a very successful and experienced actress. She's in college. Her teacher likes her enough to care about her enough to write to the mother. The mother spends the whole afternoon ruminating about her in an extremely loving way. The mother never failed in her love for her. And a child knows that. A child knows when, for example, there's studies done on it, when a child has terrible surgery and is in pain and is awful, you know. The kid is not emotionally damaged if they're surrounded by love. If they know that the mother is weeping because they're in so much pain, it takes the damage away from you. So there's, and also there is some notion about perfection and good enough parenting. I mean, which of us as parents can't point to ourselves and say, I failed my child in this way or that? And then we can say that to our parents, you failed me in this way or that. But in the end, this moral, I think, or the sort of message of the story, is that people are resilient, their gifts will out. Like sometimes it's like a flower blooming out of a stone, crack in a stone, you know, but that it takes a lot to ruin a human being.
But to go along with what the gentleman in the corner just said about the two boys saying, Dad, we don't remember all those horrible things you thought you did to him. The same thing in this story, where this daughter's very special gift was a gift of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that she would have had that gift if she would have thought her life was so horrible? I don't think so. I think she'd have lost
maybe,
that somewhere.
Maybe she wouldn't have had the gift if she hadn't had pain.
Right. True.
Some creativity comes out of pain.
But, you know, I don't think she would have been able to portray this great comedy that she obviously did if she thought her life was so horrible. Yeah, you can picture
right.
this
well,
child
right.
just...
Although I think a lot of comedians have painful backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
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 Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think that, I mean, I would never advocate that someone shouldn't have child care and support, and I think as a culture we're in serious trouble because our children are kind of throw them on the scrap heap. We don't give priority in our public policies to children. We don't as a culture cherish our children. We don't as a culture cherish our traditions and our cultures, and I think we're just dangerously careless with all of that stuff. But I think that the message in this story is in part that individual mother's love or parent's love or somebody's love for a child is very redeeming,
mm-hmm.
and that there's much good that comes from love in poverty.
But is it that we should just take care of the children, but I think you took better care of the parents
right.
than the parents. If they take better care of the parents,
yes.
then they could be able to take better care of their children.
If this 19-year-old parent
Wasn't she 19 when she became a parent?
And so now it's her daughter who was 19.
Oh, but, I didn't think of her.
But the parent had been 19 when she began, and absolutely right. She needed support. She needed a job. And,
like the gentleman, sorry, I'm
Mark.
He would have taken better care of his parents in society, so that then they would be able to take better care of the children. I think that's the thing all around.
Exactly.
You need to take care of the children, you need to take care of the community.
So, and I'm going to talk about that this evening when I talk about death penalty. if we valued our human lives, as assets in this country, in this culture, we would surely not damage so many people. So, thank you very much. You've done wonderfully well. You've figured it all out.